Now, Hong Kong doesn't matter so much, but one of the things we are frightened of is that in Malaya, for example, you've got the Malaya does matter very much to you as well as to ourselves, and matters to all the United Nations.
It certainly does.
Rubber, tin, and so on. Well, in Malaya, you've got this very large number of Chinese who are not themselves, or very few of them, are communists. But there's not any doubt that if they feel that the British Commonwealth is at war with China, is bombing Chinese ports, or even blockading Chinese ports, not very much doubt that a great number of those Chinese would then add very much to the difficulties of the British, in other words, the difficulties of the United Nations in Malaya and so on. I think your point about Hong Kong is a fully justified one, and I think that, fully justified, but it certainly has a lot of justification, and I think it is one of the things on which your government is probably very wise in pressing our government.
Vernon, I'd like to check another point with you. There's occurred a rather remarkable shift in public opinion in this country. When we first went into South Korea, all of the polls and surveys, you know, we like to take polls and surveys,
yes,
and count heads and
yes,
make unscientific conclusions from unscientific facts.
We follow your example.
But at the time we went into South Korea, there was indicated a support of something like 85 or 90% of public opinion for the president's action. Well, now, in recent weeks, senators and congressmen in Washington have been getting mail that runs, 90, 95 to 1 in favor of our pulling out of Korea immediately. The latest public opinion poll showed something like 65 or 70% of those questioned believing that we should come out of Korea. What's the attitude in Britain about that?
Well, my attitude is I'm most interested to hear that. I didn't realize there was that growing feeling about it. As far as the ordinary British attitude is concerned, I think that in the early days, we did feel very strongly that it was one of the most unfavorable territories in which we could possibly be called upon to defend the United Nations, in that it's got a common frontier with both China and a small common frontier with the Soviet Union, whereas we've got to bring everything overseas. I mean, you've got to bring everything, all the supplies and all the men overseas. We did feel, therefore, that it was a very, very bad territory to have to defend. Now, as for getting out, I'm a bit surprised, because I think the general feeling here now is that the chances of holding on to it are better than they ever were, better than they were since the first days of the disaster in the north. And that you now, if you hold this Pusan bridgehead, the Chinese would have such very, very long lines of communication and in supplying their men in the front that they would be exhausting what little they have in the way of mechanized vehicles and so on. And that, therefore, if we can stay on there, it probably does exhaust them, exhaust the Chinese a good deal, and thereby lessens the danger to Indochina and other places.
Well, I think myself we're going to stay, Vernon. The
yes,
decision has been taken, and our military men are, one might almost say supremely confident that we can stay.
Yes.
That we can cut up those Chinese divisions and relieve thereby, as you say, the pressure on Malaya and Indochina as well.
Yes. But as far as the effect on people's concerned, of course it would depend entirely what you did with your troops after you pulled them out. I think most of us feel, as I say, that the situation was completely changed for the United Nations once the Chinese came into Korea in a big way, and that it would be quite legitimate for the United Nations to say, well, we have done our best to defend it, to help Korea, to liberate Korea. Effort has been checked by the intervention of the Chinese, and we can't therefore carry out our original program at the present time. And in order to strengthen the United Nations forces against the powers of darkness that are obviously stronger than we had expected, we are pulling out altogether. I think there's an additional reason. Very few people, I'm afraid, in either country, thinks very much about the unfortunate Koreans themselves. And I don't think they're going to have much fun if the process of their liberation is going on for a very long time.
No, that's certainly true. And that tragedy would be emphasized by the fact that the South Koreans have fought magnificently. I saw them out there last summer. And they fought with inferior equipment, but with really tremendous courage and tenacity.
Yes, I've not been there.
But Vernon, on this point of our pulling out, I think we might clear up one aspect of it. And this is a purely personal opinion, but you will remember during the last war when the argument went on here as to whether we should put our major weight in Asia or in Europe.
Yes.
We decided in the war to put it in Europe. I think in this period of no war, no peace, we have made the same decision. And I believe that that is a decision that is going to be adhered to. And unless we stumble into a major war in Asia, I can see no possibility at all that we are going with our eyes open to undertake a major action out there, which would mean draining off our potential strength from Western Europe.
Well, that's very encouraging to us in Western Europe, and not only because we are Western Europeans, but obviously the great industrial power of Western Europe can't be lost to the United, to the Western powers without a disaster for you as well as for us. Ed, there's one point I'd like to take up on that, though. You said unless we stumble into a war in the Far East, and that brings me back to this business that we are definitely afraid that if we do brand China the aggressor, we shall be dragged along into sanctions, which in turn will develop into limited war, and which again in turn will develop into a major war. I do assure you that a great many people here who are just as anxious as anybody in America, both to maintain Anglo-American friendship and to see that the United Nations doesn't collapse, a great many of them are really frightened that stronger action against China at the present time, however justified it is on moral grounds, will do precisely what happened in the Italian-Abyssinian dispute in 1935. What I have in mind is this, that unless you can be absolutely sure that all the important members of the United Nations are wholeheartedly in agreement that sanctions must be carried out, you may get a resolution adopted which which pledges a lot of people to things for which they have governments to things for which they've got no public support. And you will remember yourself in the old days in the case of the Italian invasion of Abyssinia, we were anxious that sanctions should be carried out. There were some powers that weren't so anxious. You got a condemnation of Italy, which was only half-hearted. Sanctions were half-hearted. And the net result was that you made it absolutely inevitable that Italy and Germany should side together. Now, what we've got to do, surely, is to see that that doesn't happen with China and Russia.
Yes, of course, one fallacy of those who advocate a limited war is that they fail to realize that in order to limit a war, both sides have got to agree to limit it. And we can have no assurance, of course, that the Chinese would do that. But, Vernon, again, on this point of referring to what you said earlier about MacArthur's speeches.
Yes.
You have undoubtedly read in the last few days of some of our generals who have been sounding off on the subject of dropping atom bombs and so forth, and bombing Chinese communications and railheads and
so
forth. I think those statements must be read in the light of the fact that our military men talk more freely and more loudly than do yours. And I cannot discover any considerable responsible sentiment in Washington that is advocating anything more than the branding of China as an aggressor and probably the application of economic sanctions.
Yes, well, Ed, on that basis, I don't think the gap between the two countries is as wide as the gap is between us at the present time. I mean, the geographical gap. I don't think the gap of ideas is so immense. Of course, there is obviously quite a different tradition in that your military men do express opinions on political matters much more freely than ours do. And I think also, of course, there is this fact that, as you said earlier, you haven't experienced war on your territory, and we, and still more most people on the continent, have done so. Now, of course, that does mean that we are more anxious to keep out of war. I don't know that that's true, but it does mean that knowing a bit more about war at first hand, we are very, very cautious about it. But it doesn't mean, I think that we are dragging our feet, as so many people in America believe.
Vernon, this is a point that it is very difficult to explain to Americans. I have been trying for a number of years myself as a result of having spent the last war in London. But it just isn't possible to bridge the distance or to substitute intelligence for experience. I think the best thing I've seen on this subject in a long while appeared in a newspaper in Paris the other day when they wrote that for America, defeat would mean disaster, and for Europe, war would mean disaster.
Yes. Well, there is that. Yes, there's a lot in that. But I don't really think that... I think there's another thing that you know very well, because you know this country so intimately. I think that it's underestimated in America the extent to which we haven't had any let-up since the end of the Second World War. I mean, it has been such a difficult struggle the whole time. And that, again, does mean that we appear to show less enthusiasm than a younger, more virile nation such as the United States.
Vernon, there's another point about our policy that I think is perhaps worth mentioning. Do you in Britain, the whole matter of maintaining armed strength to support policy is an old story. The maintenance of alliances is an old story. For us, it isn't. It is only 5 years, after all, since we decided, for the first time in our national history, that we needed allies in peacetime, that we required strength in order to support policy. Now, this is something of a new experience for us, which is an old story to you. And for that reason, I think you will find, as you have already indicated, that the language of our debate is rather more intemperate than it is in your country. We are more eager, more impatient, because throughout most of our national history, we have sought easy and quick solutions. Generally, we have found them. We're now in a position where we can't see a solution that is either easy or quick, and therefore we're inclined to rather lash out at our allies and anyone else who happens to be convenient.
Yes, well, Ed, I'm afraid we have to stop. Our time's up, but I would just like to end on that note, because there are a lot of people in the criticism here that you get of America. There are quite a number of people who in the old days used to curse the Americans because they were too isolationist and now curse them for interfering too much. We do appreciate that there has been this tremendous change in America, and as I say, most of us here do appreciate that the most important thing for the maintenance of civilization is the maintenance of Anglo-American friendship. Goodbye, Ed. Thank you very much.
Come over and see us soon.
Well, I will. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Goodbye. You've been listening to London Forum, which this week was a discussion between Vernon Bartlett in London and Ed Morrow in New York.